This is Audible.
From the Wizarding Archive. Curated writing from the world of Harry Potter by J.K. Rowling. Forward by Ivana Lynch. I remember a very particular door of my youth, and the many evenings spent sat in front of it, willing it to open and divulge its secrets. It was about as plain a door as you could imagine, remarkable only for its ordinariness, a windowless wood-paneled door with a small gold lever handle. And yet it captivated my attention for hours on end. I sat, staring at those dark oak panels, my frustration mounting as I schemed various ways to get through this mysterious door. Minutes ticked by as I searched for patterns in the wood and scrutinized the hinges. The only sounds the low hum of a radio, a fly occasionally buzzing through, and a set of chimes clinking gently together as the wind disturbed them every few moments. While I waited, I'd flick the light switch on and off, or take to reviving the plant on the windowsill with an acid green glowing potion. Oh, it wasn't a real door. It was an animated drawing of a door on jkrowling.com. This website comprised a chaotic jumble of paraphernalia you might find on the desk of J.K. Rowling, and when you nudged crumpled up papers out of the way and clicked on feathers or caught a spider, tickled and prodded the website just so, it revealed untold treasures for a young Harry Potter fan. These included tea-stained drawings of characters, elegantly rendered in spidery penmanship, an early draft page of a chapter from Philosopher's Stone, Sorcerer's Stone to visitors from the US, ink blots obscuring some of the words, as well as almost familiar names scribbled out on lined pages, their rhythms toyed with in the margins. And then there was the door. That impenetrable brown door that you reached via a glowing pink eraser on the desk, and that guarded the website's most covetable secrets. It only opened a handful of times over the years, and only after you'd answered a series of riddles or puzzles. It was through this door that the world learned the titles, covers, and release dates of the final Harry Potter books, precious knowledge that sparkled with promise. The door remained firmly shut for far more days than it could be opened, sitting solidly there, usually bearing a Do Not Disturb sign, which signaled that a certain magic was happening just beyond it, that of creation and imagination, the author hard at work. I knew it wouldn't open on those days, and yet I wondered if I could wait it out, staying longer than anyone else, and when it assumed nobody was listening, catch a whisper of its latest revelation. In my father's cozy office, the smell of roast potatoes and gravy drifted under a very real doorframe, telling me time was passing in my life. But I often just stayed there, insisting that I have dinner before the keyboard or do my homework with the Wizarding radio humming in the background, convinced that tonight might be the night the door opens and I discover something magical that no one else had seen before. It was always with a heavy sigh and a feeling of faint disenchantment that I closed the website and re-emerged to face Muggle life. But my thoughts would snake their way back to that room, fixated on the door and the infinite mysteries it guarded. Why did it hold such fascination for me? I've wondered that as I pored over the writing in this book, some snippets of which first appeared beyond that door. Why did it override my rational thinking and growing acceptance of the firm line between reality and fantasy? I think it was because the world beyond the door felt completely unknowable. No matter how much time passed, or how many pearls of wisdom the door gifted us, you could never know all the secrets of the wizarding world. In fact, the wizarding world only seemed to make more sense the more questions you asked of it, arranging itself parallel to our world. And that door, the door that looked so unremarkable that most harried muggles wouldn't throw it a second glance, seemed to twinkle with an aura of magic, because it felt like a portal between our world and Harry's. The door opened for the final time with the publication of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows in July 2007, with J.K. Rowling writing that the secrets she had carried with her for years would now be passed on to the fans. And while this moment may have signaled the conclusion of Harry's time at Hogwarts, we were far from knowing all the secrets. In retrospect, the release of the final book seemed to herald a new chapter for the larger wizarding world, which has continued to diversify and sprawl in 1,000 different directions ever since. Throughout the years she was writing the books, Jo often hinted in interviews at the boxes and boxes of notes on the backgrounds of characters, spells and subplots that had never seen the light of day, but instead lay in her attic, collecting dust. So you can imagine the practically dizzying sense of euphoria felt by the fans with the launch of Pottermore in 2012, when it became clear that rather than being a figure of speech, boxes of notes suddenly seemed a slight underestimate. Quite honestly, it felt like those imposing wrought iron gates of Hogwarts had been flung open, all the muggle-proofing charms undone, as we were rewarded with reams of writing on everything from family lineages and other wizarding schools to complex descriptions of the qualities of wand cores and precisely how hard it is to become an animagus. Characters who grew to be bigger parts of the stories than previously plotted, and those no less intriguing who sadly never made it past their author's bullet point descriptions. Histories of wizards stretching back to Merlin, Nicholas Flamel, dark wizards we'd never even heard of, and a short bio of every single Minister for Magic from 1707 to the present day. These are some of the articles laid out in what follows, the majority of which were published in 2013 and 2014 on Pottermore.com. Some of them contain author's notes, where J.K. Rowling shares more personal reflections, such as source inspirations for names and characters, as well as writerly insights on the joys and pitfalls of deciding the precise parameters of a magical universe. It should be noted as well that all the articles in this book were written in advance of both the Harry Potter and the Cursed Child play and the Fantastic Beasts films. This collection discusses events that happened throughout the series. There's much to enjoy here for newcomers and established listeners alike, but those determinedly avoiding spoilers should know that J.K. Rowling's collected writings reflect on key events throughout all 7 books. To the seasoned fan, for whom rereading the Harry Potter books is something of a necessary reorienting experience, this book will only add more dimensions to the original stories. How your jaw will drop to discover the source of Harry's family's fortune is the hair product that Hermione uses for her iconic makeover for the Yule Ball. A fact Harry mustn't have known himself, judging by his many fruitless attempts to flatten his famously unruly mop. How your heart may hurt for a young Professor McGonagall who made a difficult choice. How you might be appalled to hear that a willful enchanted book almost stopped Neville Longbottom from getting to Hogwarts. Or intrigued to learn that Luna Lovegood's dreamy essence appeared on the page as a student named Lily Moon, even before Lily Potter had her name. How real-world magic seemed to be in the ether when J.K. Rowling unknowingly situated an important magical gateway over the grave of an ancient warrior queen. Above all, what this book reminds us as we submerge ourselves deeper in wizarding history is that for all its fantastic beasts and otherworldly enchantments, Harry's story has always had profound resonance in our reality. I found it interesting to observe how rereading these books at different stages throughout life can act as a mirror, reflecting one's inner preoccupations and growing awareness of the world, as new themes and characters you'd previously overlooked emerge and come into focus. As a quiet, creative child who longed to find a kindred spirit, I felt comforted reading about the adventures of a trio of unusual, idealistic young people who found each other. Now, as an adult, different themes strike my heart. The loneliness of Remus Lupin, the fallibility of Dumbledore, the preciousness of true friendship. But what strikes me most of all when I reread the books now, so keenly it seems to ring off every page, is the deep yearning of Harry for his parents' love. It's interesting, isn't it, that as children we accept the world as it is, however it's explained to us. Harry, a boy who never knew his parents, snuck out of bed to find an enchanted mirror, and it was all part of the adventure. Yet now when I read the books, I can hardly think of a more heartbreaking image than that of a little boy traipsing through dark corridors at night to gaze through a mirror for hours into the smiling faces of his parents, and how he continued to search for that unconditional love elsewhere, everywhere. What Harry has to learn over the course of his journey to defeat Voldemort is that his search is fruitless. His mother's love never left him. Instead, it binds with magic and runs through his veins, creating a protective shield that the most powerful dark magic cannot overcome. Ultimately, Harry's is a story that delivers hope, courage, and humility, as we too are reminded that there is no magic in any world more potent, magnificent, and abundant as love. I hope as you immerse yourself back in the lore of Harry Potter, you'll come to notice the many portals connecting our world to the magical one. They are hiding in plain sight, ready to be discovered or rediscovered if you look carefully and ask yourself, is it really just a door, a boot, a map, a book? And so, to repeat a common refrain echoed in the days of the wooden door that would cause a flurry of activity and excitement rippling through the fandom, the door is open! I repeat, the door is open! Let's step inside. Chapter 1. The Dursleys. Let's start with the very ordinary beginning of Harry Potter's extraordinary story. Before Dumbledore pops up with his put outer. Before the stern-looking tabby cat stalking Privet Drive reveals herself to be Professor McGonagall. Before Hagrid arrives with baby Harry on the back of Sirius Black's flying motorbike. Back before any of that, it is the Dursley name we learn first, in the opening sentence of that first book, Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of No. 4 Privet Drive were proud to say that they were perfectly normal, thank you very much. Since Harry's story starts with the Dursleys, a family of muggles seemingly far removed from the wizarding world, it feels only fitting to start this collection with a look at the Dursley's own origin story. Particularly his aunt, Petunia Dursley, who is definitely not quite as far removed from the wizarding world as she might like. The Dursleys of No. 4 Privet Drive are the antithesis of anything magical. But when Dumbledore leaves baby Harry on their tidy doorstep, he's not simply hoping to stir up some long-buried notion of familial responsibility. No, he is quite literally relying on the bond of blood Petunia shares with her sister Lily, a brave witch who has just given her own life to save her sons. As Lily's sole surviving relative, Petunia's blood carries within it the lingering magic of Lily's sacrifice. And so it is that Petunia, who has spent years deliberately rejecting the wizarding world of her younger sister, becomes a central part of the magic that will protect Harry for most of his childhood. Thus, Harry's story begins in the company of his muggle relatives on the doorstep of their house in Little Whinging on a dull grey Tuesday. At first glance, it is all very ordinary. But as we know, Harry's life is anything but ordinary, and not even the Dursleys can escape that for long. In this chapter, J.K. Rowling peels back the curtains of No. 4 Privet Drive, providing us with ample opportunity to peer in. Vernon and Petunia Dursley. By the time Harry appears on the Dursleys' doorstep, Petunia and Lily are long estranged. Having firmly closed the door on her sister's family, Petunia is happily ensconced in her snug, smug, muggle life, along with her boorish husband Vernon and the son she dotes on. And yet, as children growing up in Cokeworth, she and Lily had been close. Petunia had been envious of Lily's magical abilities, even once writing to Dumbledore to ask if she could also attend Hogwarts. For her part, Lily tried often to comfort and include her big sister, particularly when Petunia began to feel left behind by Lily's growing friendship with Severus Snape. So what happened during those intervening years? Why couldn't Petunia put aside her feelings and welcome her nephew with the love her sister had always shown her? And what on earth happened when Vernon Dursley, beefy and pompous, fond of cars, met James Potter, thin face and untidy hair, fond of turning into a stag, for the first time?
Harry's aunt and uncle met at work. Petunia Evans, forever embittered by the fact that her parents seemed to value her witch sister more than they valued her, left Cokeworth forever to pursue a typing course in London. This led to an office job, where she met the extremely unmagical, opinionated, and materialistic Vernon Dursley. Large and neckless, this junior executive seemed a model of manliness to young Petunia. He not only returned her romantic interest, but was deliciously normal. He had a perfectly correct car and wanted to do completely ordinary things, and by the time he had taken her on a series of dull dates, during which he talked mainly about himself and his predictable ideas on the world, Petunia was dreaming of the moment when he would place a ring on her finger. When, in due course, Vernon Dursley proposed marriage, very correctly, on one knee in his mother's sitting room, Petunia accepted at once. The one fly in her delicious ointment was the fear of what her new fiancé would make of her sister, who was now in her final year at Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry. Vernon was apt to despise even people who wore brown shoes with black suits. What he would make of a young woman who spent most of her time wearing long robes and casting spells, Petunia could hardly bear to think. She confessed the truth during a tear-stained date in Vernon's dark car as they sat overlooking the chip shop where Vernon had just bought them a post-cinema snack. Vernon, as Petunia had expected, was deeply shocked. However, he told Petunia solemnly that he would never hold it against her that she had a freak for a sister. And Petunia threw herself upon him in such violent gratitude that he dropped his battered sausage. The first meeting between Lily, her boyfriend James Potter, and the engaged couple went badly. And the relationship nosedived from there. James was amused by Vernon and made the mistake of showing it. Vernon tried to patronize James, asking what car he drove. James described his racing broom. Vernon supposed out loud that wizards had to live on unemployment benefits. James explained about Gringotts and the fortune his parents had saved there in solid gold. Vernon could not tell whether he was being made fun of or not and grew angry. The evening ended with Vernon and Petunia storming out of the restaurant while Lily burst into tears and James, a little ashamed of himself, promised to make things up with Vernon at the earliest opportunity. This never happened. Petunia did not want Lily as a bridesmaid because she was tired of being overshadowed. Lily was hurt. Vernon refused to speak to James at the reception, but described him, within James's earshot, as some kind of amateur magician. Once married, Petunia grew ever more like Vernon. She loved their neat square house at number 4 Privet Drive. She was secure now from objects that behaved strangely, from teapots that suddenly piped tunes as she passed, or long conversations about things she did not understand with names like Quidditch and Transfiguration. She and Vernon chose not to attend Lily and James's wedding. The very last piece of correspondence she received from Lily and James was the announcement of Harry's birth. And after one contemptuous look, Petunia threw it in the bin. The shock of finding their orphaned nephew on the doorstep a little over a year later was, therefore, extreme. The letter that accompanied him related how his parents had been murdered and asked the Dursleys to take him in. It explained that due to the sacrifice Lily had made in laying down her life for her son, Harry would be safe from the vengeance of Lord Voldemort as long as he could call the place where her blood still existed home. This meant that number 4 Privet Drive was his only sanctuary. Prior to Harry's arrival, Petunia had become, if anything, the more determined of the Dursleys in suppressing all talk about her sister. Petunia had some latent feelings of guilt about the way she had cut Lily, whom she knew in her secret heart had always loved her, out of her life. But these were buried under considerable jealousy and bitterness. Petunia had also buried deep inside her, and never confessed to Vernon, her long-ago hope that she too would show signs of magic and be spirited off to Hogwarts. Reading the shocking contents of Dumbledore's letter, however, which told her how bravely Lily had died, she felt she had no choice but to take Harry in and raise him alongside her own cherished son, Dudley. She did it grudgingly and spent the rest of Harry's childhood punishing him for her own choice. Uncle Vernon's dislike of Harry stems in part, like Severus Snape's, from Harry's close resemblance to the father they both so disliked. Their lies to Harry on the subject of how his parents had died were based largely on their own fears. A dark wizard as powerful as Lord Voldemort frightened them too much to contemplate, and like every subject they found disturbing or distasteful, they pushed it to the back of their minds and maintained the died-in-a-car-crash story so consistently that they almost managed to persuade themselves it was true. Even though Petunia was raised alongside a witch, she is remarkably ignorant about magic. She and Vernon share a confused idea that they will somehow be able to squash the magic out of Harry, and in an attempt to throw off the letters that arrive from Hogwarts on Harry's 11th birthday, she and Vernon fall back on the old superstition that witches cannot cross water. She had frequently seen Lily jump streams and run across stepping stones in their childhood, she ought not to have been surprised when Hagrid had no difficulty making his way over the stormy sea to the hut on the rock.
Author's note. Vernon and Petunia were so called from their creation and never went through a number of trial names, as so many other characters did. Vernon is simply a name I never much cared for. Petunia is the name that I always gave unpleasant female characters in games of make-believe I played with my sister Di when we were very young. Where I got it? I was never sure. Until recently, a friend of mine played me a series of public information films that were shown on television when we were young. He collects such things and puts them on his laptop to enjoy at leisure. One of them was an animation in which a married couple sat on a cliff enjoying a picnic and watching a man drowning in the sea below. The thrust of the film was, "Don't wave back, call the lifeguard." The husband called his wife Petunia, and I suddenly wondered whether that wasn't where I had got this most unlikely name, because I have never met anybody called Petunia, or, to my knowledge, read about them. The subconscious is a very odd thing. The cartoon Petunia was a fat, cheery character, so all I seem to have taken is her name. The surname, Dursley, was taken from the eponymous town in Gloucestershire, which is not very far from where I was born. I have never visited Dursley, and I expect that it is full of charming people. It was the sound of the word that appealed, rather than any association with the place. The Dursleys are reactionary, prejudiced, narrow-minded, ignorant and bigoted, most of my least favourite things. I wanted to suggest, in the final book, that something decent, a long-forgotten but dimly burning love of her sister, the realization that she might never see Lily's eyes again, almost struggled out of Aunt Petunia when she said goodbye to Harry for the last time, but that she is not able to admit it or show those long-buried feelings. Although some readers wanted more from Aunt Petunia during this farewell, I still think that I have her behave in a way that is most consistent with her thoughts and feelings throughout the previous books. Nobody ever seemed to expect any better from Uncle Vernon, so they were not disappointed.
Marge Dursley. Vernon Dursley's big sister Marge is, if possible, even meaner to Harry than her brother. But then Vernon knows Harry has magical abilities. Marge does not. If she did, perhaps she might not goad Harry quite so much. Although, if the following glimpse into Marge Dursley's life is anything to go by, perhaps even magic wouldn't have stopped her meanness.
Marjorie Eileen Dursley is the older sister of Vernon Dursley. Although no blood relation of Harry Potter, he has been taught to call her Aunt Marge. Marge is a large and unpleasant woman whose main interest in life is breeding bulldogs. She believes in corporal punishment and plain speaking, which is what she calls being offensive. Marge is secretly in love with a neighbour called Colonel Fubster, who looks after her dogs when she is away. He will never marry her due to her truly horrible personality. This unrequited passion fuels a lot of her nasty behaviour to other people. Marge dotes on Dudley, her only nephew. She does not know that Harry Potter, who lives with her relatives, is a wizard. She believes him to be the offspring of two unemployed layabouts who dumped their son on their hard-working relatives, Vernon and Petunia. The latter, who are terrified of the prejudiced and outspoken Marge finding out the truth, have fostered this impression over many years. When Harry becomes angry with Aunt Marge, who has been insulting his parents, and loses control over his magical abilities, she is blown up like a barrage balloon. Two members of the Accidental Magic Reversal Squad must be dispatched from the Ministry of Magic to deal with this incident and modify Aunt Marge's memory. From that time forward, the Dursleys do not invite Marge to stay while Harry is in residence, and he never sees her again.
Author's note. I regret making Aunt Marge a breeder of bulldogs, as I now know them to be a non-aggressive breed. My sister owns one, and he's the most lovable, affectionate dog you could hope to meet. On the other hand, they do look grumpy, and on appearance alone, seem to suit Aunt Marge.
Cokeworth. The unassuming town of Cokeworth is another seemingly ordinary Muggle setting, where there is a fair bit going on beneath the surface. After all, it was the place where Harry Potter's least favourite teacher, Severus Snape, met and developed feelings for Harry's mother, Lily Evans. And those feelings go on to impact more than Snape's own life. They are an unseen force that also shape Harry's destiny, affording him another level of protection he knows nothing about. And it all started in apparently mundane Cokeworth.
Cokeworth is a fictional town in the English Midlands where Harry spends a night at the Railview Hotel with his aunt, uncle, and cousin Dudley. Cokeworth's name is supposed to suggest an industrial town and to evoke associations of hard work and grime. Although it is never made explicit in the books, Cokeworth is the place where Petunia and Lily Evans and Severus Snape all grew up. When Aunt Petunia and Uncle Vernon are trying to evade the letters from Hogwarts, they travel to Cokeworth. Perhaps Uncle Vernon has a vague idea that Cokeworth is so distinctly unmagical, the letters will not follow them there. He ought to have known better. After all, Petunia's sister Lily turned into a talented witch in Cokeworth. It is therefore Cokeworth that Bellatrix and Narcissa visit at the start of Half-Blood Prince, where they visit Snape at his parents' old house. Cokeworth has a river running through it, evidence of at least one large factory in the long chimney overlooking Snape's house, and many small streets full of workers' houses.
Chapter 2. The Potters and the Malfoys. Most of Harry's Muggle relatives would never have been aware of the wizarding world were it not for his existence. But for wizarding families like the Potters, Harry's father and all their magical ancestors, living alongside Muggles is a fact of life, albeit not a fact everybody is happy about. For families like those of Harry's archenemy Draco Malfoy, Muggles are vastly inferior. Even Muggle-borns like Hermione and Harry's mother Lily are to be looked down on, disparaged as mudbloods. Those who sympathise with these views define themselves as having pure blood, i.e. blood that has never mingled with that of a Muggle. The concept has a long history. At one point in the 1930s, a directory was even published to list all the pure blood families, and, unsurprisingly, this so-called Sacred 28 list included the Malfoys. Happily, the Malfoys are not representative of every Sacred 28 family. The Weasleys are openly and famously welcoming of everyone. Neville Longbottom's parents were respected aurors, and Hufflepuff Ernie Macmillan, whose family name also appears on the Sacred 28 list, is a staunch, if occasionally pompous, supporter of Harry's. Then there are the many wizarding families whose names are not on any list, but who are nonetheless entirely magical. Which brings us back to the Potters. The Potter family. When Harry comes across the Mirror of Erised in Philosopher's Stone, he's transfixed by what he sees. It is his family. Not just his parents, but relatives of all kinds, crowding round and smiling out at him, as the mirror reflects what Dumbledore describes as Harry's deepest and most desperate desire. Harry's circle may be limited to just the disappointing Dursleys, but no matter how small and unsatisfactory his immediate family unit, Harry has ancestors, lots of them, according to the Mirror of Erised, including several magical generations of Potters, from whom Harry inherits his thin face, a Gringotts vault full of gold, and, perhaps even more significantly, the invisibility cloak that becomes central to many of his escapades.
The Potter family is a very old one, but it was never, until the birth of Harry James Potter, at the very forefront of wizarding history, contenting itself with a solid and comfortable existence in the backwaters. Potter is a not uncommon Muggle surname, and the family did not make the so-called Sacred 28 for this reason. The anonymous compiler of that supposedly definitive list of purebloods suspected that they had sprung from what he considered to be tainted blood. The wizarding Potter family had illustrious beginnings, however, some of which were hinted at in Deathly Hallows. The wizarding family of Potters descends from the 12th century wizard Linford of Stinchcombe, a locally well-beloved and eccentric man whose nickname, the Potterer, became corrupted in time to Potter. Linfred was a vague and absent-minded fellow, whose Muggle neighbours often called upon his medicinal services. None of them realised that Linfred's wonderful cures for pox and ague were magical. They all thought him a harmless and lovable old chap, pottering about in his garden with all his funny plants. His reputation as a well-meaning eccentric served Linfred well, for behind closed doors, he was able to continue the series of experiments that laid the foundation of the Potter family's fortune. Historians credit Linfred as the originator of a number of remedies that evolved into potions still used to this day, including Skelligrow and Pepperup Potion. His sales of such cures to fellow witches and wizards enabled him to leave a significant pile of gold to each of his seven children upon his death. Linfred's eldest son, Hardwin, married a beautiful young witch by the name of Iolanthe Peveril, who came from the village of Godric's Hollow. She was the granddaughter of Ignotus Peveril. In the absence of male heirs, she, the eldest of her generation, had inherited her grandfather's invisibility cloak. It was, Iolanthe explained to Hardwin, a tradition in her family that the possession of this cloak remained a secret, and her new husband respected her wishes. From this time on, the cloak was handed down to the eldest in each new generation. The Potters continued to marry their neighbours, occasionally Muggles, and to live in the west of England for several generations, each one adding to the family coffers by their hard work and, it must be said, by the quiet brand of ingenuity that had characterised their forebear, Linfred. Occasionally, a Potter made it all the way to London, and a member of the family has twice sat on the Wizen Gamut. Ralston Potter, who was a member from 1612 to 1652, and who was a great supporter of the Statute of Secrecy, as opposed to declaring war on the Muggles, as more militant members wished to do. And Henry Potter, Harry to his intimates, who was a direct descendant of Hardwin and Iolanthe, and served on the Wizen Gamut from 1913 to 1921. Henry caused a minor stir when he publicly condemned then-Minister for Magic, Archer Evermond, who had forbidden the magical community to help Muggles waging the First World War. His outspokenness on the behalf of the Muggle community was also a strong contributing factor in the family's exclusion from the Sacred 28. Henry's son was called Fleamont Potter. Fleamont was so called because it was the dying wish of Henry's mother that he perpetuate her maiden name, which would otherwise die out. He bore the burden remarkably well. Indeed, he always attributed his dexterity at dueling to the number of times he had to fight people at Hogwarts after they had made fun of his name. It was Fleamont who took the family gold and quadrupled it by creating magical Sleakeasy's hair potion. Two drops tames even the most bothersome bonnet. He sold the company at a vast profit when he retired. But no amount of riches could compensate him or his wife Euphemia for their childlessness. They had quite given up hope of a son or daughter when, to their shock and surprise, Euphemia found that she was pregnant and their beloved boy, James, was born. Fleamont and Euphemia lived long enough to see James marry a Muggle-born girl called Lily Evans, but not to meet their grandson, Harry. Dragonpox carried them off within days of each other, due to their advanced age, and James Potter then inherited Ignotus Peverell's invisibility cloak.
The Malfoy family. The Malfoys may not have been descended from the Peverells of Beedle the Bard legend, but as a family, they are pretty good at creating their own mythology. And, as the following history lesson demonstrates, they've never been averse to twisting a tale if it will suit their own ends. Looking back on several hundred years of Malfoy sin and spin, it seems some things never change.
The Malfoy name comes from Old French and translates as bad faith. Like many other progenitors of noble English families, the wizard Armand Malfoy arrived in Britain with William the Conqueror as part of the invading Norman army. Having rendered unknown, shady and almost certainly magical services to King William I, Malfoy was given a prime piece of land in Wiltshire, seized from local landowners, upon which his descendants have lived for 10 consecutive centuries. Their wily ancestor Armand encapsulated many of the qualities that have distinguished the Malfoy family to the present day. The Malfoys have always had the reputation, hinted at by their not altogether complimentary surname, of being a slippery bunch, to be found courting power and riches wherever they might be found. In spite of their espousal of pure blood values and their undoubtedly genuine belief in wizard superiority over Muggles, the Malfoys have never been above ingratiating themselves with the non-magical community when it suits them. The result is that they are one of the richest wizarding families in Britain, and it has been rumoured for many years, though never proven, that over the centuries, the family has dabbled successfully in Muggle currency and assets. Over hundreds of years, they have managed to add to their lands in Wiltshire by annexing those of neighbouring Muggles. And the favour they curried with royalty added Muggle treasures and works of art to an ever-expanding collection. Historically, the Malfoys drew a sharp distinction between poor Muggles and those with wealth and authority. Until the imposition of the Statute of Secrecy in 1692, the Malfoy family was active within high-born Muggle circles, and it is said that their fervent opposition to the imposition of the statute was due, in part, to the fact that they would have to withdraw from this enjoyable sphere of social life. Though hotly denied by subsequent generations, there is ample evidence to suggest that the first Lucius Malfoy was an unsuccessful aspirant to the hand of Elizabeth I, and some wizarding historians alleged that the Queen's subsequent opposition to marriage was due to a jinx placed upon her by the thwarted Malfoy. With that healthy degree of self-preservation that has characterised most of their actions over the centuries, once the Statute of Secrecy had passed into law, the Malfoys ceased fraternizing with Muggles, however well-born, and accepted that further opposition and protests could only distance them from the new heart of power, the newly created Ministry of Magic. They performed an abrupt vault farce and became as vocally supportive of the statute as any of those who had championed it from the beginning, hastening to deny that they had ever been on speaking or marrying terms with Muggles. The substantial wealth at their disposal ensured them considerable and much resented influence at the Ministry for generations to come, though no Malfoy has ever aspired to the role of Minister for Magic.
Welcome to the Ministry of Magic. Please state your name and business.
It is often said of the Malfoy family that you will never find one at the scene of the crime, though their fingerprints might be all over the guilty wand. Independently wealthy, with no need to work for a living, they have generally preferred the role of power behind the throne, happy for others to do the donkey work and to take the responsibility for failure. They have helped finance many of their preferred candidates' election campaigns, which have, it is alleged, included paying for dirty work, such as hexing the opposition. The Malfoys' unfeigned contempt for all Muggles who could not offer them jewels or influence, and for the majority of their fellow wizards, drew them naturally towards the pure blood doctrine, which seemed, for several years in the 20th century, to be their likeliest source of untrammeled power. From the imposition of the Statute of Secrecy onwards, no Malfoy has married a Muggle or Muggle-born. The family has, however, eschewed the somewhat dangerous practice of intermarrying within such a small pool of purebloods that they become enfeebled or unstable. Unlike a small minority of fanatic families such as the Gaunts and Lestranges, and many a half-blood appears on the Malfoy family tree. Notable Malfoys of past generations include the 14th century Nicholas Malfoy, who is believed to have dispatched many a fractious Muggle tenant under the guise of the Black Death, though escaping censure by the Wizards' Council. Septimus Malfoy, who was greatly influential at the Ministry in the late 18th century, many claiming that Minister for Magic Unctuous Osbert was little more than his puppet. And Abraxas Malfoy, who was widely believed to be part of the shady plot that saw the first Muggle-born minister, Nobby Leach, leave his post prematurely in 1968. Nothing was ever proven against Malfoy. Abraxas's son, Lucius, achieved notoriety as one of Lord Voldemort's Death Eaters, though he successfully evaded prison after both of Lord Voldemort's attempted coups. On the first occasion, he claimed to have been acting under the Imperius Curse, though many claimed he called in favours from high-placed ministry officials. On the second occasion, he provided evidence against fellow Death Eaters and helped ensure the capture of many of Lord Voldemort's followers who had fled into hiding.
Draco Malfoy. The first time Harry meets Draco, Draco boasts about bullying his father into buying him a racing broom, declares his Slytherin allegiance, and proudly echoes the Malfoys' pure blood beliefs, seemingly without any concern about what Harry or any other bystander might think.
I really don't think they should let the other sort in, do you? They're just not the same. They've never been brought up to know our ways. Some of them have never even heard of Hogwarts until they get the letter. Imagine. I think they should keep it in the old wizarding families.
Even as he stands on one of Madame Malkin's dressmaking stools as an 11-year-old schoolboy, Draco's focus is on money and pride, power and status. Basically, he's a typical homegrown Malfoy, cold, arrogant, and with a sneer to rival his father's. Of course, this attitude only becomes more pronounced throughout his Hogwarts years. And the mutual animosity between Draco and Harry grows steadily alongside it. Yet, Draco was born a Malfoy, so could he really have turned out any different? In the play Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, first performed in 2016, after the following article was written, we meet Draco as an adult. He has been chastened by his experiences and softened, slightly, by raising his son Scorpius. Draco reveals how lonely he'd been as a child and how much he'd envied Harry's friendships. Because it couldn't have been easy, being the only child of blood status obsessed parents. And what would it do to you, being brought up in a household that Voldemort himself felt comfortable enough to use as headquarters? For all his meanness, Draco's story has always seemed more complicated than his superior, slippery surface would suggest. So, let's look beneath that surface.
Draco Malfoy grew up as an only child at Malfoy Manor, the magnificent mansion in Wiltshire, which had been in his family's possession for many centuries. From the time when he could talk, it was made clear to him that he was triply special. Firstly, as a wizard, secondly, as a pureblood, and thirdly, as a member of the Malfoy family. Draco was raised in an atmosphere of regret that the Dark Lord had not succeeded in taking command of the wizarding community, although he was prudently reminded that such sentiments ought not to be expressed outside the small circle of the family and their close friends, or Daddy might get into trouble. In childhood, Draco associated mainly with the pureblood children of his father's ex-Death Eater cronies, and therefore arrived at Hogwarts with a small gang of friends already made, including Theodore Knott and Vincent Crabbe. Like every other child of Harry Potter's age, Draco heard stories of the boy who lived through his youth. Many different theories had been in circulation for years as to how Harry survived what should have been a lethal attack, and one of the most persistent was that Harry himself was a great dark wizard. The fact that he had been removed from the wizarding community seemed, to wishful thinkers, to support this view, and Draco's father, Wily Lucius Malfoy, was one of those who subscribed most eagerly to the theory. It was comforting to think that he, Lucius, might be in for a second chance of world domination should this Potter boy prove to be another and greater pure blood champion. It was, therefore, in the knowledge that he was doing nothing of which his father would disapprove, and in the hope that he might be able to relay some interesting news home, that Draco Malfoy offered Harry Potter his hand when he realized who he was on the Hogwarts Express. Harry's refusal of Draco's friendly overtures, and the fact that he had already formed an allegiance to Ron Weasley, whose family is anathema to the Malfoys, turns Malfoy against him at once. Draco realized, correctly, that the wild hopes of the ex-Death Eaters that Harry Potter was another and better Voldemort are completely unfounded, and their mutual enmity is assured from that point. Much of Draco's behavior at school was modeled on the most impressive person he knew, his father, and he faithfully copied Lucius's cold and contemptuous manner to everyone outside his inner circle. Having recruited a second henchman, Crabbe being already in position pre-Hogwarts on the train to school, the less physically imposing Malfoy used Crabbe and Goyle as a combination of henchmen and bodyguard throughout his 6 years of school life. Draco's feelings for Harry were always based, in great part, on envy. Though he never sought fame, Harry was unquestionably the most talked about and admired person at school. And this naturally jarred with the boy who had been brought up to believe that he occupied an almost royal position within the wizarding community. What was more, Harry was most talented at flying, the one skill at which Malfoy had been confident he would outshine all the other first years. The fact that the potions master, Snape, had a soft spot for Malfoy and despised Harry was only slight compensation. Draco resorted to many different dirty tactics in his perpetual quest to get under Harry's skin, or discredit him in the eyes of others, including, but not limited to, telling lies about him to the press, manufacturing insulting badges to wear about him, attempting to curse him from behind, and dressing up as one of the Dementors, to which Harry had shown himself particularly vulnerable. However, Malfoy had his own moments of humiliation at Harry's hands, notably on the Quidditch pitch, and never forgot the shame of being turned into a bouncing ferret by a Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher. While many people thought that Harry Potter, who had witnessed the Dark Lord's rebirth, was a liar or a fantasist, Draco Malfoy was one of the few who knew that Harry was telling the truth. His own father had felt his dark mark burn and had flown to rejoin the Dark Lord, witnessing Harry and Voldemort's graveyard duel. The discussions of these events at Malfoy Manor gave rise to conflicting sensations in Draco Malfoy. On the one hand, he was thrilled by the secret knowledge that Voldemort had returned, and that what his father had always described as the family's glory days were back once more. On the other, the whispered discussions about the way that Harry had again evaded the Dark Lord's attempts to kill him caused Draco further twinges of anger and envy. Much as the Death Eaters disliked Harry as an obstacle and as a symbol, he was discussed seriously as an adversary, whereas Draco was still relegated to the status of schoolboy by Death Eaters who met at his parents' house. Though they were on opposing sides of the gathering battle, Draco felt envious of Harry's status. He cheered himself up by imagining Voldemort's triumph, seeing his family honored under a new regime, and he himself fated at Hogwarts as the important and impressive son of Voldemort's second-in-command. School life took an upturn in Draco's fifth year. Although forbidden to discuss at Hogwarts what he had heard at home, Draco took pleasure in petty triumphs. He was a prefect, and Harry was not. And Dolores Umbridge, the new Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher, seemed to loathe Harry quite as much as he did. He became a member of Dolores Umbridge's inquisitorial squad and made it his business to try and discover what Harry and a gang of disparate students were up to as they formed and trained in secret as the forbidden organization Dumbledore's Army. However, at the very moment of triumph, when Draco had cornered Harry and his comrades, and when it seemed that Harry must be expelled by Umbridge, Harry slipped through his fingers. Worse still, Harry managed to thwart Lucius Malfoy's attempts to kill him, and Draco's father was captured and sent to Azkaban. Draco's world now fell apart. From having been, as he and his father had believed, on the cusp of authority and prestige such as they had never known before, his father was taken from the family home and imprisoned far away in the fearsome wizard prison guarded by Dementors. Lucius had been Draco's role model and hero since birth. Now he and his mother were pariahs among the Death Eaters. Lucius was a failure and discredited in the eyes of the furious Lord Voldemort. Draco's existence had been cloistered and protected until this point. He had been a privileged boy with little to trouble him, assured of his status in the world and with his head full of petty concerns. Now, with his father gone and his mother distraught and afraid, he had to assume a man's responsibilities. Worse was to come. Voldemort, seeking to punish Lucius Malfoy still further for the botched capture of Harry, demanded that Draco perform a task so difficult that he would almost certainly fail and pay with his life. Draco was to murder Albus Dumbledore. How, Voldemort did not trouble to say. Draco was to be left to his own initiative, and Narcissa guessed correctly that her son was being set up to fail by a wizard who was devoid of pity and could not tolerate failure. Furious at the world that seemed suddenly to have turned on his father, Draco accepted full membership of the Death Eaters and agreed to perform the murder Voldemort ordered. At this early stage, full of the desire for revenge and to return his father to Voldemort's favor, Draco barely comprehended what he was being asked to do. All he knew was that Dumbledore represented everything his imprisoned father disliked. Draco managed, quite easily, to convince himself that he, too, thought the world would be a better place without the Hogwarts headmaster, around whom opposition to Voldemort had always rallied. Enthralled to the idea of himself as a real Death Eater, Draco set off for Hogwarts with a burning sense of purpose. Gradually, however, as he found that his task was much more difficult than he had anticipated, and after he had come close to accidentally killing two other people instead of Dumbledore, Draco's nerve began to fail. With the threat of harm to his family and himself hanging over him, he began to crumble under the pressure. The ideas that Draco had about himself and his place in the world were disintegrating. All his life, he had idolized a father who advocated violence and was not afraid to use it himself. And now that his son discovered in himself a distaste for murder, he felt it to be a shameful failing. Even so, he could not free himself from his conditioning. He repeatedly refused the assistance of Severus Snape because he was afraid that Snape would attempt to steal his glory. Voldemort and Snape underestimated Draco. He proved adept at occlumency, the magical art of repelling attempts to read the mind, which was essential for the undercover work he had undertaken. After two doomed attempts on Dumbledore's life, Draco succeeded in his ingenious plan to introduce a whole group of Death Eaters into Hogwarts, with the result that Dumbledore was indeed killed, though not by Draco's hand. Even when faced with a weak and wandless Dumbledore, Draco found himself unable to deliver the coup de grace because, in spite of himself, he was touched by Dumbledore's kindness and pity for his would-be killer. Snape subsequently covered for Draco, lying to Voldemort about Draco lowering his wand prior to his own arrival at the top of the Astronomy Tower. Snape emphasized Draco's skill in introducing the Death Eaters into the school and cornering Dumbledore for him, Snape, to kill. When Lucius was freed from Azkaban shortly afterwards, the family was allowed to return to Malfoy Manor with their lives. However, they were now completely discredited. From dreams of the highest status under Voldemort's new regime, the Malfoys found themselves the lowest in the ranks of the Death Eaters, weaklings and failures, to whom Voldemort was henceforth derisive and contemptuous. Draco's changed, yet still conflicted personality revealed itself in his actions during the remainder of the war between Voldemort and those who were trying to stop him. Although Draco had still not rid himself of the hope of returning the family to their former high position, his inconveniently awakened conscience led him to try, half-heartedly perhaps, but arguably as best he could in the circumstances, to save Harry from Voldemort when the former was captured and dragged to Malfoy Manor. During the final battle at Hogwarts, however, Malfoy made yet another attempt to capture Harry and thereby save his parents' prestige and possibly their lives. Whether he could have brought himself to actually hand over Harry is a moot point. I suspect that, as with his attempted murder of Dumbledore, he would again have found the reality of bringing about another person's death much more difficult in practice than in theory. Draco survived Voldemort's siege of Hogwarts because Harry and Ron saved his life. Following the battle, his father evaded prison by providing evidence against fellow Death Eaters, helping to ensure the capture of many of Lord Voldemort's followers who had fled into hiding. The events of Draco's late teens forever changed his life. He had had the beliefs with which he had grown up challenged in the most frightening way. He had experienced terror and despair, seen his parents suffer for their allegiance, and had witnessed the crumbling of all that his family had believed in. People whom Draco had been raised, or else had learned, to hate, such as Dumbledore, had offered him help and kindness, and Harry Potter had given him his life. After the events of the Second Wizarding War, Lucius found his son as affectionate as ever, but refusing to follow the same old pureblood line. Draco married the younger sister of a fellow Slytherin. Astoria Greengrass, who had gone through a similar, though less violent and frightening conversion from pure blood ideals to a more tolerant life view, was felt by Narcissa and Lucius to be something of a disappointment.